Like most of the CIA veterans who got caught up in this secret war, Alpert loved doing to the Soviets in Afghanistan what they had done to the Americans in Vietnam. One of his most satisfying moments came right at the beginning of his work with Avrakatos. When the Mujahideen captured a collection of Soviet 122mm rockets, the fuses wouldn't work, and no one knew what to do with them. But Alper knew this terror weapon well from his Vietnam days. One of the Soviet 122s that the Viet Cong fired from the jungle had hit next to Alper's office, and the concussion had been so great that it had hurled the desks and safes all over his room. He loved the idea of turning some of those Soviet rockets back where they came from. After a bit of tinkering, Alper declared that he could make them work just so long as he was allowed to use American fuses, which he would attach with his own specially tooled thread adapters. Again, that meant breaking the prohibition on any American-made items, even components. Art's the type of nice little Jewish boy who always checks with his mother, and since he didn't have his mother, he always checked with me, recalls Avrakatos, who immediately signed off without consulting the lawyers. If I asked them, they would have jerked off for 3 months trying to figure out why we couldn't do it. There weren't all that many 122s, but the Mujahideen reacted with childlike delight when they fired these magnificent noisemakers into Kabul. It was a morale booster for the freedom fighters to be terrorizing the infidel in his own lair. Avrakatos was now working to toughen the agency's tactics, but by later standards the war he was presiding over in 1983 was remarkably tame. Congress had appropriated only $15 million for the Afghans that year, concealed in an Air Force appropriation. The Saudis, convinced that the Soviets would come after them next if they were not stopped in Afghanistan, had agreed to match the U.S. commitment to the Mujahideen dollar for dollar and to permit the CIA to direct the program. This still meant only $30 million to run a guerrilla war 12,000 miles away against a superpower then able to intimidate every nation in the world. $30 million is what 2 F-15 fighter jets cost, or 6 Black Hawk helicopters. It was not just insufficient funding, however, that Avrakatos saw as the central problem. It was bureaucratic cowardice. He talks about a Nuremberg syndrome loose in the upper echelons of the bureaucracy, where officers like Chuck Cogan lived in terror of another congressional investigation or of being hauled up by a special prosecutor. By the time the lawyers were finished talking to the Chucks of the agency, he says, we couldn't do anything but play with our dicks because the lawyers worried that our weapons would be perceived as terrorist devices, or worse, as assassination devices. Later, when Avrakatos took over the Afghan program, he dealt with this problem by introducing an Orwellian change in the language he directed his staff to adopt whenever describing weapons or operations in the Afghan program. These aren't terrorist devices or assassination techniques, he would inform his staff. Henceforth, these are individual defensive devices. Sniper rifles were finally shipped out to the Mujahideen, but only after Gust renamed them long-range night vision devices with scopes. Once, when the Islamabad station sent a cable describing a lethal tactic being introduced, Avrakatos shot back a return communique saying that the cable had been garbled and adding, please do not send anything more on this subject ever again. Avrakatos talks about the lawyers during these days almost as if they were predators patrolling the halls of Langley. Even Saturday Night Live couldn't do justice to the way the lawyers made us deal with Afghanistan. It got so bad, he says, that when he planned to begin planting anti-Soviet stories in the European press, an assistant secretary of state objected, claiming that the propaganda might bounce back and mislead Americans, in which case the agency would be in violation of congressional laws that prohibit the CIA from operating inside the United States. Soon, groups of State Department lawyers and CIA lawyers were caught up in endless meetings debating whether the possibilities of this blowback were strong enough to deny the operation. Avrakatos's solution to this internal sabotage was to enlist an old CIA friend, a New York Jew, a lawyer who had balls, to join the Afghan task force as my consigliere. Larry Penn was another of those nondescript, slightly overweight middle-aged men you would never notice in an airport. Technically, he was the task force operations officer. But Avrakatos says he deployed Penn regularly to design methods of countering the agency's other lawyers. Penn would constantly warn Avrakatos that he was going to end up in the slammer, but the balding, bug-eyed consigliere happily carried out the tasks Avrakatos gave him. When sensitive initiatives were being proposed and lawyers were expected at an agency meeting, Avrakatos would send Penn to represent him. The consigliere's instructions were to employ euphemisms and to drone on with boring double talk so long that he would make the entire operation seem tedious. As Avrakatos saw it, he almost had to run a covert operation inside the agency to get things going out in the field. But he wasn't quite as radical as he might appear. The main reason for his boldness with the lawyers was that he interpreted the presidential findings differently than they did. When Avrakatos talks today about the findings Jimmy Carter signed shortly after the Russians invaded, he makes them sound almost as if they were sacred documents. He says they are far and away the most comprehensive lethal findings ever commissioned, the equivalent of a presidential declaration of war. What makes them doubly unusual is that they were authored by that ultimate liberal and supposed critic of CIA covert operations, Jimmy Carter. Avrakatos, however, also insists that Carter had no idea he was signing such a blank check, and this would appear to be a reasonable conclusion, given the fact that ultimately the findings authorized operations that helped kill as many as 25,000 Soviet soldiers. Ironically, Avrakatos says his predecessor, who authored those findings for Carter to sign, also had no intention of having them used for an all-out killing war. They were, he says, quite literally written to provide the agency with an insurance policy. My predecessor wrote it that way because he didn't want to be left there with his dick hanging out if Carter forced him and the CIA to do stupid, counterproductive, dirty tricks in Afghanistan and Congress decided to investigate. He did it to cover his ass and his troops from Watergate-type, Nuremberg-type, Church-type attacks. And this guy is smart and he had the balls to do it. Avrakatos was at the helm when most of the weapons that did the killing were funneled to the Afghans, and he says he always kept those Carter findings in his desk. And I told everyone with me to make sure they were always there and to take copies whenever we left. They are the orders of the President of the United States until rescinded. I told our lawyers, meaning Larry Penn, never to ask for clarification, never to ask if the findings authorized what they authorized. When the war winds down, I thought maybe we would have need for them again. I'd hide them and keep them, but then I'm a dinosaur. To get those four findings again would take a miracle. It's easy to identify with Avrakatos's frustration. For the first time in the Cold War, the CIA was operating with presidential findings that authorized the CIA to mount operations to kill Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan. Given that fact, it made little sense to claim that it was somehow legitimate to provide guerrillas with hundreds of thousands of AK-47s, tens of thousands of heavy machine guns, landmines by the thousands, not to mention millions of rounds of ammunition, all given with the explicit hope that they would be used to kill Russian soldiers, and then at the same time to claim that providing the Afghans with sniper rifles would somehow violate presidential bans on assassination plotting. But then the lawyers had a different agenda than Avrakatos. They were trying to protect the Central Intelligence Agency, and they had a vivid memory of what happens in Washington when the political winds start shifting. Their job was to identify the most unfair interpretation anyone could possibly put on a covert operation, and if it could be somehow construed as prosecutable, no matter how absurd, they took the position that the agency should back off. Throughout his Afghan tour, Avrakatos did things on a regular basis that could have gotten him fired had anyone chosen to barge into his arena with an eye toward prosecuting him. But then Avrakatos was not just lucky. He was brutally worldly wise, keenly aware of the internal risks he was taking, and so he always made it difficult for anyone to get to him should they try. He left no paper trail. He always surrounded himself with like-minded outcasts who understood and approved of his code of conduct. Above all, he became a master manipulator of the system, capable, by sheer bureaucratic skill, to take the agency into areas others would not have thought possible. As Avrakatos is the first to acknowledge, however, none of the astonishing things that he was able to do later to transform the Afghan War would have been possible had it not been for Charlie Wilson. But back in the summer of 1983, Wilson didn't look like anyone's champion. In fact, he looked like a sorry old drunk who was about to be knocked off by his own government.